The Senate Judiciary Policy Committee will come to order. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. And we've been asked to give our thoughts on Senate File 1701. And instead of just giving feedback to the Health and Human Services Conference Committee that is considering Senate File 1701 because it's in the House, I felt that it was the responsible thing to allow members of the Judiciary Committee to have input on this. We had Senate File 1701 on the schedule, but at the end, when we came to the time crunch, this was something that was going to take quite a bit of time, as we will see today. And we thought that next session, this being a biennium, would be a good opportunity to give it a thorough consideration in the Judiciary Committee. But as it turns out, I think that the work of another committee would like to have a chance to take a look at this. And so I've asked the Health and Human Services Conference Committee to give us an opportunity to have our input. I think that, and I hope what we do today in this committee will reflect the work of this committee and will help to establish a Senate position as they consider this. And if they choose to negotiate this language, I would hope that the good work that this committee has chosen to put into it today, even long after our policy work has been done, I would hope that, the work that we do today will be taken into consideration in those negotiations. So, we have before us Senate File 1701, Senator Betzel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 1701 is called the Minnesota Health Records Act. This bill, we have the first engrossment. This was heard in the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee and then referred to this committee, actually without recommendation, because a lot of the issues that are in here are data practices issues, and the that committee felt that those issues are more properly within the province of this committee, and they didn't want to take a position on something that they were not too sure about. So that's, but they did have quite an extensive hearing in that committee as well, too. The bill that you have before you, a lot of it is just recodification of current law. But to the extent that there are new provisions in there, it's probably easier for me to describe the process that we're doing in here so you can get a feeling for what this is all about. This is part, the bill comes before you as the result of something called the Minnesota eHealth Advisory Committee, which were involved a number of stakeholders that met over the legislative interim, and they had come up with they wanted to look at how to handle medical records now that we're into the electronic age. And the fact is that medical records, although we have a number of laws for protection of patients' rights and how to handle records, they were mainly written for a paper age. Two major concepts that are coming out with electronic records: the fact that they are generating records that are now stored in computers in and of itself is a change, but the big problem is somehow if you're going to store medical records electronically, there has to be some way to access them, obviously. If you go to your own clinic and they try to find your medical records, there has to be some database, somewhere they can go to find your records and pull them out. You know, multiply, add to the fact that many of the clinics, healthcare providers, and so forth have affiliations, they are tied into other healthcare providers, and whether we have legislation or we don't have legislation, databases are being created. They are happening, so that if you go to your own clinic and they're affiliated with some other clinic, they may very well be able to share back and forth, whether it's medical records or just your name or something, because if they're going to try to retrieve records, somehow they have to do that. So this does raise issues about access to information, what kind of information, consent, and so forth in dealing with electronic records. The bill that we have before you does a couple of things, and there's a couple of key concepts in here. One, we refer to something called a record locator service. That is a compilation of I guess, patient identifications, names, not medical records, but who people are, so that when you go to a record locator service, you can find out where the medical records are maintained, what hospital, what clinic. It doesn't tell you necessarily what the clinics have, because that's within the purview of those. But these things are being created right now. We're not talking about a government database. We're talking about how the industry is trying to use the computer technology to better serve their patients. So that if you are going into a clinic and your provider, your physician, whoever is treating you, wants access to something else that somebody else has, you say, well, there's some. I was treated at North Memorial Hospital or Fairview Hospital or whatever. Today, they can contact them with your consent and go and find out, okay, what records are available there. As this technology is moving ahead, it's clearly going into a trend where it's developing so that these providers are going to try to share and create databases so that there are independent databases so that one provider can contact the database and say, we have a patient here, we're trying to find out their medication background, what their treatment background for whatever it is that we're looking at, where do we go, and the database points that, okay, this patient is there. Now, you can already see that there's going to be a number of issues relating to that. What this bill does is says that, first of all, if you're going to a provider, if you are being treated somewhere, that they could enter your name and where you were treated into a record locator service. Again, not your medical information, but just who you are and where information could be found. But now, who's going to have access to that? Only healthcare providers. So it isn't something that's open to the public. It has to be somebody legitimately who has a need to know that you have, that there's information about you, and where should we go on that. Now, the provider has to give the patient the opportunity. You can completely opt out of this record locator service as part of your consent process. You don't have to consent to letting anybody go to this record locator service, and in fact, if you want to now get out of that record locator service, you have that opportunity to do so. If anybody does access any information, they have to maintain a log to show who accessed that particular information. And if there's inappropriate disclosures of patient information, the record locator service would be liable. And they're also subject to all state, federal laws on sensitive data. I stress that all this is a data. These are databases that we're not creating under this bill, but we are recognizing that because of the way things happen with electronic records, people are creating these kind of databases right now, and so we are trying to set up the parameters as to how they are to be done, what information they're to have, what the patient rights are. Now, assuming that the patient, you go to a provider and they want to have access to find out if you've got any medical records, maybe something that happened years ago that you don't even remember. If you consent to that, you have to give a consent to access the database, and then the provider would have to fax a form to the other provider who's got your medical information asking, and you have to sign the consent. You have to consent, just as you do today, for somebody else to release your medical records, and so you have to consent not only to checking your name in the database, but also releasing any information at the original treating facility. So those parts are consistent with current law for the consent. As I say, this mainly is trying to set up the parameters of the database. I'll turn it over to Mr. Golden, who's from the Department of Health, and he can go into a little bit more detail, on this proposal. And I know there's individuals both for and against the bill, so we'll go there.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, committee members, I think Senator Betzel did a very good job at describing kind of the key issues in this bill. I would just add a couple of quick notes. The healthcare industry is investing hundreds of millions of dollars to properly use health information technology to try to deliver better, safer, and more efficient care. Part of this effort is trying to make sure that providers have the information they need as they're treating patients that happen to be in front of them. The legislature and the governor set up the eHealth Advisory Committee to look at issues to try to coordinate overall public and private sector activity in this area. And as we were investigating this, one of the largest barriers that was encountered by this group was the fact that our patient consent requirements in Minnesota were really based much more on a paper model that was developed as much as 30 years ago. And what this tries to do in this bill is to try to update these requirements to facilitate the electronic exchange, the real-time electronic exchange, so that providers who are and physicians who are treating patients have the ability to get the information with the patient's consent from other providers who may have information relevant to the treatment or diagnosis of that patient. It does maintain the protections that Senator Betzelt had mentioned. Both the record locator service has a number of protections, as well as in using the representation of consent. A couple of protections there just to add to the ones Senator Betzelt mentioned. The idea of the representation of consent is it's to eliminate the piece of paper that has to flow through the system today. So today, when a person's at a provider and they need records, they sign a consent at that provider, but then it's faxed to the disclosing provider. It takes a significant amount of time for that provider to process that, determine if that's going to meet their requirements inside their organization, do something with the piece of paper, and then get the records back to that treating provider. And the information's really not available. What this does is it still requires that treating provider to get the consent before they can get any records, but it allows that treating provider to communicate electronically to the disclosing provider that they have obtained the patient's consent for the information that they are requesting as part of their treatment of that patient. Some of the protections associated with that in this bill, only a healthcare provider may request a patient's records using the concept of representation. The requesting provider still needs to get the patient's written consent. As part of releasing the records using a representation, the disclosing provider needs to document the requesting provider who's requested the records, the patient whose information has been requested, the information that's actually been requested, and the date of the request. And then the liability section tries to allocate liability to any bad actors in the exchange.
And Madam Chair, if I could just
members,
we've got something a little bit different, but in your packet there is a copy of the bill as it comes to this committee, and what is marked in yellow is new. That which is not marked, especially that which is underlined, is current law. So you can, a lot of this was recodified in order to make this put this bill together, but the truly new language is that which is marked in yellow.
Senator Betzel or Mr. Golden, I'm wondering if you could use an example, kind of walk through the process, because I've read through the bill and I have some questions and you've presented it, but I think it would help some of the members to get a concrete example if you could use a hypothetical example and walk us through how the mechanics of this would actually work.
Sure. Maybe an example would be, for example, if you take someone like my mother, she has a number of chronic illnesses, and she has seen a number of physicians, been to a number of clinics and hospitals over the last 5 to 7 years for a variety of conditions. Unfortunately, her memory is not as good as it once was, so when she goes to a physician, one of the first questions they would want to know is about some of her other conditions which may impact on the treatment of her, and particularly they would be very interested in what medications she might be taking. At that point, because my mother would not be able to remember all of the locations that she had, the idea of a record locator would help her treating physician identify where those records might be in order to request those records. So when she's there, they say, you know, one of the things that we need to properly treat you would be some information about your medication history, and depending on what they would be treating her for, some other conditions, diabetes, for example, that she might be getting other care for at another provider. She would then be asked to sign a consent, which would allow that provider to access a record locator service that helps.
It's the cannon.
Been going off all day.
That helps to identify where her records are. She would at that point be presented with a consent form. The consent form would tell her that there is a record locator service, that it does contain information about the location of records, and as part of that consent form, if she objected to even being in the record locator, she could check an opt-out box, at which point the provider would make sure that she has totally opted out of that record locator system. Assuming that she does not, at that point, that once she signs that consent, the provider would be able to query the record locator to identify where her records are. It doesn't provide any information about her actual health condition, just simply where to go for those records. At that point, they would then decide, we would like to be able to get your medication history. They would ask for a consent that says, in order to treat you for this, we need your medication history. It would be a standard consent that's very consistent with what there is today. At that point, presumably, she would sign that. Once that's signed, they have electronic connections to the other people that are participating in their health information exchange. They would send a request for medication history to the locations where her records have been identified as being located. And as part of that, they would communicate to that disclosing provider, to the provider that they're requesting the records from, that they have the consent necessary for the medication history. The disclosing provider would note that the provider has sent that, that is my mother, that they're asking for medication history, and it's the particular date. And then the information would go through a standard, national standard kind of message associated with medication history back to the treating provider with all of the information about my mother's history, medication history, for example.
This would all take place in one office visit, in one sitting, Mr. Goldman?
That's correct.
And so at each provider, presumably there would be one person who will be managing the system to respond to just the medical electronic requests?
Madam Chair, committee members, I believe the idea is that the electronic systems would communicate with each other electronically and record that information. So, for example, Hospital A's electronic health record would be able to send a message to Hospital B's electronic health record. Part of that message would be a requirement, of course, to indicate whether you have the consent necessary for the information you're requesting, if it's a medical emergency, something along those lines, and then it would come back automatically. So within each system, depending on the hospital system, there may be many people that operate the electronic health records, the personal health records, and the exchanges.
And then, Mr. Goldman, the query that is entered into the system, what kind of query would it be to make sure that you have your mother's name is Mary Olson, and we have a Senator Mary Olson, and that you have the proper Mary Olson's medical records?
Yes, the information that would be entered in would be something that would be traditionally held as part of a provider's medical record in much the same way it's done on paper today when you're trying to identify the correct Mary Olson, as the case might be. The information would generally be the patient's name, their address, date of birth, gender. One very good piece of information is the parent's name as well, or maiden name. The bill also permits other non-clinical information. The most common non-clinical information that would be used would be either a health plan ID, or if there were a national health identification number, there's not today, but if there were one of those, that would probably be the best piece of identification.
Mr. Golden, in an office setting, the nurse who was helping my physician would come in and they would prep all of this as part of the office visit. They would do the query, get my consent, do the query, get all this information back to the doctor, and then the doctor would be able to, given this information in one sitting, look at all the information and the history, and then be able to give me the proper treatment in one sitting.
Madam Chair, committee members, that is the goal.
And then, Mr. Golden, before my doctor can query about the information, I would already have to be in the system. So does the bill assume that most medical clinics now have electronic records of all of their patients, or is the bill also hoping to be an impetus to providers to put all of their patient information into an electronic format?
Madam Chair, committee members, I would say that the bill assumes that there is an ever-increasing number of healthcare providers that have electronic health records. Among hospitals today, there is a very high percentage of hospitals that currently have an electronic health record. Among clinics in the urban area, in large clinics, it is a reasonably high proportion. As you move to smaller clinics or to the rural areas, the numbers decrease. However, as I said initially, one of the things that we see in Minnesota is private sector organizations are literally investing hundreds of millions of dollars to implement these technologies in their facilities. Also, in both the Senate and House omnibus bills, there is a mandate that all hospitals and healthcare providers would have an interoperable electronic health record system in place. In the Senate bill, it is by January 1st of 2015. In the House, it's January 1st of 2012. So I think that these things are happening today at an ever-increasing rate, and this is trying to make sure that we have privacy laws that are consistent with that changing environment.
So, Mr. Goldman, under the current practice, is there a kind of a disclosure or a form of, I know this isn't, they're private, so they're not obligated to give something like a Tennyson warning, but is there some kind of a warning, a disclosure to the patients that as we move into the electronic age of putting your records into electronic format, we could end up in a situation where, you know, your records could be subject to electronic transfer here and there? Is there any movement in that direction? What I'm reading from the bill is that the assumption is that patients will automatically just get put into an electronic format that will one day link up with this system if the legislature were allowed this to happen. And I don't know if the current patients who are allowing themselves to be put into an electronic record format, if they knew that that system would get hooked up to this kind of a broader system, if they would ask for an option to opt out of being an electronic record patient. Mr. Goldman.
Madam Chair, committee members, I don't think today most organizations that have an electronic health record provide the opportunity to opt out of it within a medical facility or clinic setting. That would essentially require a dual system. One would be a paper system, one would be an electronic system. My understanding, and certainly providers in the room could comment on this even more fully, that they are having one system. And an electronic health record system is ultimately going, even within, forgetting a cross-organizational exchanges, will provide safer, better care. Because the doctor, for example, won't be looking for the chart when it's at the nurse's station for dictation. They will be able to put in your medications into an electronic health record that will automatically review any prescriptions that are written against that to see if you have any allergies or contraindications, or if there would be any interactions between the drugs that might be prescribed. So as of today, I don't know of any organization that is running a dual system.
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, sure. And it's surprising that my other life is a lawyer in civil commitment cases. I've seen a lot of the metro area hospitals have converted over from the three-ring binder chart that they used to keep on the wards for the patients, and now it's all on computers. If you ask to see the chart, it's an empty binder. You have to have, and each hospital has different policies and how, who has to sit there and access the records and call them up so that the lawyer can look at the patient's records and so forth. But they've done it, and they're not gonna back up. But I think that the current law on the privacy of the records, who has access to them, I think that readily transfers over to whether it's paper or electronic. What is different is the fact that this is kind of like a card catalog system that is being created with these databases, because the old way of looking up old records, you can't do that anymore. So with the computers and having to be able to query and find it even within a given clinic is done electronically, more sophisticated. And now, as I say, it's not too much of a leap to figure out that all these systems are out there, and each clinic, each provider, each hospital has their own record keeping system, and they're going in the direction where they're going to try to at least interact at least the names. Now, I don't see anything that is in this bill or in current law that would allow them, two unaffiliated facilities, to share medical records back and forth. I don't think that the current law would allow anything like that under paper, whether it's paper records or electronic records. But we're talking about just the figuring out who the patient is and where records might be, which is kind of like an electronic card catalog system.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson and then Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold and Mr. Golden, I've also in private practice spent a lot of time dealing with helping patients obtain copies of their medical records, and so I've had about 15 years experience in the area of dealing with these consent forms and dealing with many different healthcare facilities as far as how this is being handled right now, especially out in rural Minnesota where we don't have as many electronic records. And as Mr. Golden knows, I've spent quite a bit of time talking to the Department of Health about some amendments that I'm going to be proposing that are consumer related and as far as making access easier and less expensive for them. But the big difference I see with how we're treating electronic records compared to how we're treating paper records is that with paper records, we require the facility that's going to release the records to have an authorization that's signed by the patient. And the difference with electronic records is it seems like it's the person requesting the records who's going to have this authorization, and the receiving the entity where the records are being requested from is just going to take the word of whoever it is that's asking for the record that they have some kind of appropriate authorization. And we are so fussy about what goes on those authorizations when we're dealing with paper records and the medical records facilities that store these records are extremely stringent about following the letter of the law in terms of what these authorizations state. This seems to be a real reversal of that kind of concern. And as a practical matter, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, what are the kinds of situations where someone maybe doesn't want their records released from a particular provider? And from my dealings with this, right away I can think of, well, let's say someone has had mental health treatment or drug treatment or maybe even they've just had a plastic surgery, or who knows what. But there are all kinds of different kinds of treatments that a person might be sensitive to making available as part of their general medical record. The way we have this set up, in order for them to preclude access to those places, they would have to name those places to the person that they don't want to have that information. It seems like you'd have to tell your doctor. Now, maybe there's something 20 years ago that you don't necessarily want that doctor to be aware of, that if that's your right because it's your record, you're going to have to tell him about that place in order for him not to get that information or not to find out there are records in that location. That seems kind of backwards to me. It seems that the person should be able to indicate to the location that stores those records that they don't want those records released if that's the choice they're making. So
Let's do this, members. Before we start to debate the bill, I want to make sure you all understand kind of initially what the bill is about. So if you've got questions to clarify what's in the bill, let's ask those questions. And we have people who've asked to testify, so I would like to give, you know, 15 minutes to the testifiers to give us their thoughts on this. And then we have a whole bunch of bills, a whole bunch of amendments that have been drafted that I'd like to work through the amendments. So any clarifying questions about what's in the bill right now before we go to talk about specific pieces and maybe looking at amendments and such? Yeah. Senator Lemmer?
Chair, Senator Betzold made a comment, and I'm just wanting to, in setting up the bill, I just wanted to ask him a question. Senator Betzold, you said something, nothing allows records to pass to other systems. Do you think that's a violation of what we have in existing law? Is that what you said?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, I don't know of any current law that would allow one clinic to just pass medical records, you know, say my records, to a clinic that, you know, I didn't consent to sending to a different clinic and so forth without my authorization. I don't see how they can do that. If I permit it, if I'm up in, say, Bemidji, and I need medical treatment, and I say, well, there's medical records down in Fridley, you can access to. Well, they can fax things back and forth, you know, today, if I consent to that. But if I don't give that consent, I don't see how the clinic in Bemidji can access the records that I have. I have to consent to that.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, let's say you weren't the subject of the request for information. Let's just say that hypothetical Bemidji Hospital just wanted Don Betzold's medical records, in addition to maybe a couple thousand other records that they wanted to have just to review some. Maybe they're doing a study. Maybe they're doing research. Maybe they're just nosy. Maybe they want to know if someone else has some for a reason of epidemiological reasons. They're pursuing some hunch or something. Should they have a right to grab that information without your consent?
Madam,
is this the balance?
Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, under current law, as I understand it, without my consent, or unless they've got some other legal authority that grants them access to it for whatever reason, unless there's some state or federal law that grants them access to it, I don't see how they have access to it.
The only concern I have, or one of the major concerns I have, is once this information gets kind of airborne on an online system, then the security becomes weaker. And all we have to do is look at our driver license records in the state of Minnesota and look at the abuse that's happened there. And actually, I think there's been two major breaches since the last I know. We were told when that came through our committee years ago that we were assured that there would be absolute protection of those records, and found out that our system is just as human as what we make it, and it's prone to be either accidentally weakened or intentionally cracked into. I'm a little concerned every time we start making wholesale changes to our data privacy laws like this. And now we've, at least this committee has spent maybe all of maybe 25 minutes on it this year. So I'm just concerned. This is a big chunk of law to change and add to, and it's taken years for the state to get to this point, and now we're wanting to change things rather quickly, and this type of law requires probably more careful thought and subject it to concepts of how it can be abused. And I know that we're not all prone to think like that, but we have to muster imagination and try and figure out how this could be intended for bad, intentionally intended for not so protective purposes.
Senator Limmer, once this committee has given the time that we can, if it's this committee's desire to send this bill forward with no recommendation and with the comment that, you know, we think it needs more work, then by all means, that's the feedback we should send this bill forward with. So what I'm a little bit concerned about is I know that Senator Olson has a couple of amendments. I know public safety is going to go in at 3:30. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to get the testifiers up here to give us their thoughts, and then I'd like to have Senator Olson be able to present her amendments before she leaves to go to public safety, and then the rest of us can talk about, you know, I mean, all the other amendments. Senator Neville, is that all right, or do you need to clarify something?
Madam Chair, I was going to ask some questions about the penalty section, but
Can we get the testifiers and then we can go back? Maybe we can have those questions answered while once we start working on the bill, because that's where it's going to lead to, I think, in some of the questions. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't believe that this record locator system is a web-based system like you're thinking the driver's license system is. This is, the way I understand it, it is like a database that tells you who to go to get to the information. It isn't that you go to the record locator system service, and it's a web page where you can go pull that data off. It is not at all like the driver's license, the DPS system. I'm kind of like you. I'm not the biggest privacy advocate in the place, but I think that we don't want records to be accessed by the wrong people. But this is at least a two-step system that I think keeps us from having the problems that you talked about.
Let's get Mr. Michael Unlin and Professor Joe Olson to the table together, and then we'll take your testimony, and then we'll take the other two testifiers.
Madam Chair, I was just here in case there were amendments that I might have some interest in. But
I see. Thank you. There will be probably amendments, so we'll give you an opportunity to respond to those if they do come up. Ms. Unlin, did I say that your name right?
Yes, you did, Chairman. Appreciate that. Madam Chair and Committee, thanks for letting me speak on this. My original thoughts in terms of when I saw the announcement this morning for people to come to speak and looking up the bill and seeing where it related to things.
Ms. Unlin, can you state your name for the record?
Michael Unlin.
And you don't represent any organization?
I'm representing myself and other citizens, and some of whom are in a very particular situation of vulnerability that I'd like to address. Actually, there's two levels of vulnerability. But in listening, I understand that most of the bill is associated with some new things associated with record locator services, data practices issues, even though there's a lot of language here that's more general and what I was thinking of. So I'm going to have to, in situation, think about what I need to say here. Like many things that are important, I think we're sitting on kind of a two-edged sword here. It's been said that speed kills. From some direct experience that I've been involved in over this last year, I think lack of speed kills too. And I think that one of the things that this is trying to do is to address how sometimes speed can be life-altering, life-saving. And people can be in vulnerable situations in an emergency room or even in a clinic. and rapid access through record locator services to other people or other places that a person may have been could make the difference between life and death. Balancing that with the privacy concerns that Senator Betzold and others referenced, I'm very sympathetic to. I'm the kind of person who refuses to give out a Social Security number to anybody I am not legally required to. I drive health insurers crazy that way, but they eventually will give me their own number because I like privacy, and I don't want everybody knowing everything about me. On the other hand, I've been in situations of recent where access to medical information that might have been helpful to the people who were overseeing my care could have been very important. And here's where I'm going to speak about groups that I loosely or informally represent. Mental health arena, mental illness arena. I suffer from pretty serious mental illness that cropped up in the last 4 or 5 years. And on multiple occasions, I have been in a hospital, and they would not have a way to look up that I was in another hospital. And they might have been able to get information that may have really been beneficial right then and there. I think that even in non-emergency situations, but maybe some sense of speed being necessary should allow information about information to be able to flow so that people can communicate quickly. I worry about the abuse when there might not be speed critical, you know, needs to get information about me that I might want to not be about me. And I'll give an example. I had the unfortunate opportunity as part of the troubles to find myself in jail wrongfully, blah, blah, blah. It was all dismissed. But while there, I needed medical treatment. And at no time did any nurses or anything like that maybe look at, gee, where did I just come from, which was a hospital, to find out how should we maybe treat this situation versus any other inmate off the street. And if not only the information was available, but in some senses, in emergency situations, in an emergency room, as somebody suffering mental illness in a jail, it should almost be required, because otherwise they're not going to treat people the way that they really need to be treated, and they are not in a position to know that. And I think that can happen in emergency situations. So, you know, kind of speaking out of both sides of my mouth, which I've, you know, have a hard time with, but it's just the way it hit me as I was listening to this bill and the focus on the record locator services. I have deep concerns that I share with Senator Betzold. I also have deep concerns about information not flowing quickly when it's needed, or even moderately needed.
We understand. Thank you for your input. Senator Foley?
Just briefly, how do you see, it seems to me that you're suggesting that you might want to give some of your information to the medical provider, but not all in some instances. And how do you propose that they segregate the data?
I think in my, you know, humble kind of opinion, and from the perspective not as a professional but as a victim of mental illness, is that there balance there between when speed is needed or appropriate and when it isn't. If I walk into a doctor's office and I've hurt my leg and he wants to, you know, look at the record locator service to see where I've been, the fact that I was seen by Hennepin County Sheriff Office, Hennepin County Medical Center nurses, I don't want him to see, right? You know what I mean? It's like none of his business at that point. But if it's an emergency, the world changes, and it has to change. And I think what we're on is the point about how you limit the authorizations. In emergencies, the authorizations kind of get mushy, but if it's not that nature, I think that the authorizations coming from each individual to each provider are important, and that can be done electronically. I'm concerned about the representation problem where somebody might think they know what is in my best interest when it's not an emergency.
Madam Chair, just...
Senator Foley.
It seems to me that what you're pointing out is that you want your data available in some instances and some not, and I haven't seen how you could segregate that myself.
Well, if I'm Senator, I don't do this. All right, I'm trying to learn it. Madam Chair, Senator Foley, what I struggle with what you say is when I'm in a good position to be my own advocate for privacy, I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to select which information is going to flow in which way and not have a laundry list show up just because I said, go ahead and check, you know, where I've been seen. In emergency situations that, you know, I think other people have to start advocating for you, and good judgment needs to prevail, and you know, I know sometimes it doesn't. I don't know how else to put it. I think maybe the best thing I've heard is that this may need more work because of the complexity.
I think that we can't, we have to get more information about how the information is indexed. You know, I mean, what I heard Mr. Golden suggest, which was you would do Leo Foley, your birthday, your address, and then it would just be for, you know, medication history or for, I mean, there has to be some specific queries that are built in terms of the, you know, there has to be a system to the card cataloging so that you only use those queries to capture that information. It isn't like, you know, you just put in your name, your address, and your information, and then the whole world pops up. But I think that, and that's a conversation that I want to get to. So we'll let Mr. Unwin go, and let's bring the other two testifiers. And Senator Foley, you hang on to that thought, and we'll ask Mr. Golden more questions about the specifics.
Madam Chair,
the database.
One quick point, if I may, and it was generated by a question by either Senator Mary Olson or Senator Scheid. I don't remember which.
Higgins. Scheid's not here today.
Oh, I'm sorry. Higgins, I'm sorry. Thank you. And it had to do with the way that the paper versus the digital world works. When I was at Abbott Hospital, I was able to sign a form which they faxed over to Fairview, which released the information from Fairview to Abbott in my behest without me having to sign something for Fairview. That's okay. And so I don't see where there's a difference between the physical paper world and the digital world, where it sounded as if there was maybe a suggestion that I would need to have had a direct release at Fairview in order to get records over to Abbott. That would be an encumbrance which would be very painful to overcome going from one hospital to another or some other such thing. And I just...
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Olson, do you have a question for the witness?
Well, I was just going to clarify, because I think I did make some kind of a comment about that, and I have my comment wasn't intended to say that someone has to have an actual paper copy of a release mailed to them, because certainly we can take advantage of electronic means of sending things, but that there did have to be, as in the example that was just given by Mr. Unwin, the facility that was going to release the records did have to get something into their hands, even though it was electronic, to allow those records to be released. And that's not really being required under the current law, and that would be a major change.
Well, we'll take a look at that, Senator Olson. You hang on to that thought. Mr. Neumeister and Ms. Brace. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, if you can tell me, I'm looking at 6 minutes, Ms. Brayson, so if you can tell me when I have a minute left, I'd be obliged to you. Just getting ready a little bit here. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. For almost nearly 30 years, three decades, I worked for many part of those decades with the predecessor of Senator Foley, Senator Jean Merriam, who helped develop, number one, our state's privacy medical records. We're considered very protective, where we give choice to the patients, we give autonomy, and we give the ability to be able to control the information that it goes to be used for other services.
The packet that I've given to you is a very thorough packet. One is very specific on my comments with questions. I give you three kinds of consent forms as examples. I also give to you what the definition of concept of representation from Black Law Dictionary is. I talk to you about the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. I also give you a letter about how electronically we're starting to do patient consent at the VA. I also give you a number of surveys, and also I give you somewhat examples of what a record locator service is. I do have some concerns about the RLS, and there are a couple givens that it's important to address here. There is a distinct difference between the discussion of RLS and the discussion of representation of consent. And those differences are dealing with access to getting medical records. The third one is that no ands, if, or buts about. You just see the difference between email and how mail regularly is mailed. There's a heck of a difference on how dissemination of information can happen. One of the concerns I have, and the concerns I have is primarily on representation, is on pages 430 through 31, which is new language, 71 through 76 that talk about the documentation of it, and then 3, the yellow part, the liability, which includes those kinds of where it talks about liability and representation. Now, if you take a look at the forms or the consent forms that I share with you, there is no reason, no whatsoever, why those kinds of things cannot be done electronically. In other words, you have an electronic consent form where somehow the person can see that what they sign at provider A. And if you look at it, I also did a little diagram like provider A to provider B. One of the things that can happen, that electronic form, which, again, if you take a look at those consent forms where it gives a choice, what records, whatever, that same form should be able to go to provider B, which is disclosing the record. To use the issue of representation, and as I described in my comments, I think is a simple way of trying to deal with this issue without really doing some very thorough discussion. One of the things that I think it's important to highlight is that I was the privacy advocate. Other people might say there were other privacy advocates on there, but I was the one that was labeled the privacy advocate. And there would need to be some more work done, I think, on some of these issues. One of the other things I think, if we deal with representation, it affords less protection for privacy, and I think than what is currently. And what I also think it will do, it will make vulnerable the issue is about consequences to theft, fraud, breaches, and those kinds of things. Now, what can we do with the current issue that we have before us? I would suggest that you delete the representation issue. You delete that identification kinds of, you know, what they're asking to be documented. Delete the liability with the representation, and then, you know, come back with and do some things with that. So I want to leave then with some following comments. An established model of patient consent in an electronic health record setting would aid patients and providers in determining where the boundaries of consent are. And I think it's important for the Department of Health to do this. The Institute of Medicine, the GAO, which has done a lot of stuff, I can go on and on, the NCVCHS, which is a committee that works with and I don't think I included it. I did include the GAO thing on the back page. We talk about to do some standardization of consents, and I think we should be able to do that in the electronic form process. And then finally, I just want to make a comment based on a record that I saw and a report that was just done less than 2 weeks ago by the Department of Health on this issue. It was on the website. Mm-hmm. They have this paragraph. While the proposed legislation attempts to carefully balance those differing points of view, it may be impossible to bridge the differences and reach a compromise. In the event that it is not possible to reach agreement on modifications to Minnesota patients' consent requirements in the 2000 legislative session, the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Health Advisory Committee will continue to collaborate with stakeholders to develop a workable compromise. On the issue of representation of consent, I do have major concerns, and I think I can highlight some of those issues. Number two, I think that I said it on the bill. I'm at pretty much 80-85% in agreement with the proposed new legislation. It's that only part that I disagree with. I have some concerns about RILs, but I'm not going to get that much into it. And I come with a wealth of knowledge and experience and who has helped U.S. policymakers help some write these laws. So I come in at least with some dearth of knowledge. Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are roughly my comments, and more detailed, my testimony would be in the written format that I gave you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions? Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neumeister, you and I have both been active in dealing with the criminal data and the CRIMNET and those other things. And one of the big concerns there is the biometric identifiers. How absent fingerprints or irises or that, how are you going to identify that that's that person?
That is one of the issues when you, Madam Chair, Senator Foley, that is one of the current issues now. Even if you're doing the consent form, but at least in the issue when the consent form goes to that provider B, you have a full document kind of thing there rather than relying on the representation. That is an issue, and that's something probably down the line that they may implement. The also thing that if you look at the proposed law, which will heighten more issues, is that the representation issue is not limited just to electronic record issues. It's broad enough that it could even deal with, under current law, with paper issues, which then could avoid, you know, that consent being sent to the B provider or their discloser.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neumeister, if the consent that had to be given were tied to the person providing the records or the facility providing the records rather than to the person requesting the records, would that alleviate your concern? I mean, is that another way of saying the same thing that you've discussed as far as your concern, that we're just relying on the word of the person asking for the records and there's no consent in the hands of the facility that would be
disclosing
the location, at least, of where that there were, in fact, some records at a particular location?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, I think how it can be resolved is, for me, I think the electronic system can be addressed to where the form that is filled out, and the example that I filled out that would be filled out at A, could be sent to B in real time. B would have a copy of that. So it's full documentation rather than those little four or five things that's in the proposed bill. At least there's possibly a digital signature or whatever, if that can be discussed a little bit more, like in 325L. At least talk about recognition of digital electronic signatures. That's what I feel comfortable with at this time until we look a little bit more into it. Minnesota is on the cusp. We are leading this effort right now. And the issue is, how far do we want to go without sort of saying what some other folks are doing? Now, in my research, there are some pilot projects that are being done in Massachusetts, California, and other places that are dealing with consent itself. Very local kind of thing, not in a that get into those kinds of issues.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Neumeister, in addition to that, would you be opposed to a person, say, at the time they're treated in a particular facility, being able to indicate at the time of the treatment whether they would consent to having that medical record for that treatment posted on as a part of this directory, so that at least they're making that choice at the time, and they could maybe go back and retract it later if they change their mind, but they, at the time they're having the treatment, can make a decision whether they want that to be available for future medical purposes.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and that's where you get into the distinction of RLS and you get into where records representation. Again, they're two separate issues. You're asking me the question about the RLS. Is that correct?
No, the records, Mr. Neumeister.
Well,
the records.
I'm hearing two different things. And Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there is an issue nationally being discussed now. Should a person be able to opt in or opt out into what they call, which will be called here eventually, a Minnesota Health Information Network? And yes, I do believe that a person should be able to have choice in that regards, whether or not your full medical records should be able to be a part of this health information network. I do believe it is important for an opt-in, not to where you can just have dissemination all over. Because the term interoperability is one of the issues that's even part of the national discussion. What does that mean? When all of a sudden your record is going to be uploaded and be able to go to all different places. The RLS, which would not have any other than the name of the provider, I'll say Rich Neumeister went to Red Door Clinic. And so by those kinds of things, I personally believe more of the opt-in than what is the opt-out being proposed here. But that's not an item that I'm focusing a lot on because I think the representation is an important one for me.
Thank you, Ms. Neumeister. Ms. Tallabrace.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I do have a handout for you, which I'm going to go through. Where's the handout? Let me just, as you're getting the handout, let me just start by saying that this is not a simple recodification. I think it's been sold a bit that way. The yellow portions that are
Ms. Brace, it's not. It wasn't sold that way to the Judiciary Committee. These are substantive policy initiative, a substantive policy initiative that has been put in place. At the start of this committee, I did say that because it's so substantive, I knew it would take a lot of time and that this committee would want to look at it. And that's why we didn't cavalierly just allow the health policy, the health conference committee to take up this act, if that's what they intend to do, without full input from the Judiciary Committee. So that's not why it's here.
Madam Chair, I do apologize for that. It has been discussed that way in other committees, but I do apologize. It's true. It has not been discussed that way here. So I just want to make clear, if you look at the, if you go down here, what I have given you is the health department, a quote from the health department saying that it's a proposal for eliminating patient consent-related barriers to the electronic exchange of health information. And I want to just draw your attention to the fact that we have the strongest medical privacy law in the nation. And our concern here is that we will jeopardize that law, weaken it through this legislation. I talk here about the consent, that there be no patient consent for placing private patient data and medical information on the online centralized record locator service. And if you go to the second page, I provide a diagram for you to consider what that could look like. And when you look at the diagram, you have to understand that every location of your medical records could send that location to the record locator service without your consent, according to how the bill is now written. And non-clinical information, if you look on page 1, line 21, where it talks about and other non-clinical data which could be used to uniquely identify a patient, there's no limit to what that data could be, so I provide some options here for what could be included as data that would be available on the record locator service. I draw to your attention that that this is medical data. If you look at the type of data that's under the medical clinics, for instance, you can see that it will tell a lot about the individuals whose data is being asked for. And even though your dentist is looking for your dental data, could find out at the very same time that you have a psychologist, you work in an asthma clinic, you have an OBGYN clinic, and they know which one you've been to, Mayo, et cetera. And so the thing, of course, is that when you look at this information, it's all the information or none as it's currently provided. And then we ask the question of who owns the RLS data, who owns that data, because the RLS is supposed to be created by a health information exchange. Health information exchange is not defined in the bill, but we assume it to be corporate and government entities who are part of this health information exchange, and they create a record locator service. And they could create several record locator services, or as the HHS bill talks about, there will be grants given to regional networks to create a record locator service. So there could be 5 record locator services in the state of Minnesota, and depending on where you have gone, it's possible that your data could be in all of them. So we do not know who owns the data, who really controls it, and when something happens, is it the RLS that's accountable, all the members of the health information exchange that are accountable, or is it the provider that's accountable? Where does the liability piece come in, and how will it really work, and will the individual be sort of in a circus when it comes to actually having their being able to get legal remedy for it? And furthermore, in order to get legal remedy, it's possible that their privacy will be further damaged in an attempt to make this happen. So I do want to point out the fact that the recent Harris poll, which was talking about the national health electronic medical record system, that the Harris poll found that 62% of the public's not aware of a plan for a national electronic record system, 42% think the privacy risks outweigh the expected benefits, and 21% want the right to stay out of the system. Now, if we move on to other parts of the bill, the opt-out provision, which was put in the House, we believe to be insufficient. We look at how opt-outs work, and they typically don't provide enough information for you to know why you should opt out. And one of the things I point to in this is that there's nothing in the bill that gives you as an individual the right to this kind of a look, the right to understand all the data that is being put by all your clinics. And we've also heard a discussion that they want to put data on back 10 years, 15 years, 20. I mean, where have you been 20 years ago that you never dreamed would end up on a record locator service that your dentist could have access to? And when it comes to the time when you're at the clinic and they say, I mean, if you look at the language about this whole opt-out, yes,
Senator Neville.
Chair, you said you heard they want to go back 10, 15 years. How'd you hear that?
It was a Madam Chair, Senator Neville. It was part of the discussion in the House at different times, just mentioning the fact that we could go back and put on old records from back 10, 15 years ago.
Just in discussions in the House.
Right. Madam Chair, when we look at the process, we look at what happens at the doctor's office, and you are sick. You're really, really sick. And now you have a paper to consider. There's nothing in the bill to tell you for sure, to give you an understanding about what you're doing. If your doctor comes up and says, I'd like to see wherever you've been before for your asthma, and you say, great, let me sign this. Well, your idea is not, I mean, your idea is just that he's going to find out where you've been for you don't have any idea about all this stuff that is waiting here to be disclosed to that one doctor. The other thing is that it's not really clear in the language. The language is a bit vague as to what kind of box would be on there, how much information you would be given before you did it. And, of course, there's no consent at all for your information to be put on here. So, we're concerned about the opt-out provision. We're concerned about the audit log, because the patient doesn't actually get access to whoever has been on the record locator service to look at your information. And the term is called provider, but if you look at the definition of provider, it could be an entire hospital, and no individual names are listed. So it could be the CEO of the hospital who wants to look at one of the senators' records. It could be the ward secretary in the hospital. It doesn't, you know, we'll never know who in the hospital. And then if the patient doesn't have access to it, where will be the accountability? And then we, too, are concerned about representation of consent, and we believe that this will just allow people to share things somewhat. Willy-nilly is probably too big of a term, but it's much more freeing if all you have to do is say, yeah, we have consent, and the disclosing facility just has to take your word. This language seems to me to say that even if you as a disclosing facility want to get the actual copy of the consent, it might be that this sort of limits it. It allows the facility who wants your records to say, well, you know, the law says we don't, you know, this is what you have to have, this is what you have to accept from us. If we say we have consent, that's what you have to accept. So that's a concern for us, and you'll notice there's no definition of the term representation of consent. So it's just how it's been declared sort of to you, but it's we don't really understand for sure that it's going to happen that way. We're concerned that judges are directed to presume the validity of the records request. And then in addition to that, the definition for consent. And Mr. Neumeister talked about this a bit, but we are in a new era of electronic medical records. If you give consent for your medical records to be accessed, in this state it's for a year. In a paper medical record system, a paper goes across and says, I want the records. And the provider over there says, great, there's your records, and there it is. And for the most part, they will never request something else. In the online electronic medical record system, for 365 days a year, 24/7, once they have your consent, they can go to perhaps the portal of the hospital and look up what's the next new thing on your medical record. The patient is not thinking about this today. If the patient were thinking about this today, they may change their mind because they may go to that doctor for one thing, they may go to this doctor for another thing, and they would never understand that the doctors would have continual communication perhaps for 365 days out of the year. And so I really think, too, that this bill needs a lot more work for privacy to actually continue to be protected in the state of Minnesota. I will draw your attention to the definition section because we have not ever understood why we have the word affiliate and related health entity in there.
To wrap up, so
okay.
Please.
And then the last thing will be the Minnesota Department of Health, which in 1995 got the right to access all of our medical records. When they move online, that will be very easy for them to do. In 2003, they had to withdraw the rule because the public got wind of the fact that was going to happen. We are concerned that everything that's being done here will actually let that happen outside the public's purview because a rule was never required and the law still exists. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your input. Senator Lemmer.
Yeah, sure. Ms. Brace, in your analysis, could an insurance company find information if this, under your review of this proposal, could an insurance company find out about medical records or preconditions of individuals by access to this? Would they have access to this?
Ms. Bass?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I have to say that I do not believe that the health plans are providers. However, the hospitals are owned by clinic systems, and there's a great deal of connection between the two. The health plan, they would have to give it. Let's just say I'm wrong, and the health plan is a provider. I just really do not think it is. But let's say I'm wrong. The consent would have to come from the patient, but the consent could, if that's true, the consent would be part of probably the consent that you sign when you sign to get insurance. But I do not think, I mean, maybe...
Senator Olson. Madam Chair, I think I can answer Senator Limmer's question because I've dealt with insurance companies for similar types of things. And my guess is that the answer is directly no, they can't. This is for healthcare providers. But indirectly, because the patient has access, anytime There's a good way for the insurance companies or credit companies or employers potentially or anyone to have access to your medical information. They can require that the patient will give them an authorization to allow them access to this information. And for lots of kinds of, unless we put in law that they can't request it, which might be a good idea because of how potentially this could be misused. I'm concerned that someone might avoid treatment for mental health issues or for substance abuse issues if they know that just the name of that location is going to follow them for the rest of their life and potentially affect employment and credit and things like that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
One of the reasons I asked that question is that I certainly would not want insurance companies to gain information of individual medical records and then once knowing that, deny coverage due to pre-existing conditions. And I hope that we wouldn't write any law to further that. There was a time just a few short years ago where the insurance industry had introduced a bill in order to have DNA checks of every newborn child in the state. And that, too, raised a lot of questions by both Democrat and Republican members of the Commerce Committee. So much so that they denied that request on that bill immediately. I think the state has a, not only a state interest, but an interest to allow individuals to get as much insurance as possible without triggering any record that would be available to the to an industry that could presuppose or suggest that there might be a pre-existing condition that which would deny coverage. We certainly don't want that.
Let's get Mr. Golden back up in the hot seat. Thinking space. Mr. Golden, talk to us a little bit about how restrictive the statute is in terms of who has access to the card catalog, and then ultimately how does the access to the information at the individual clinics protect the patient from things like Senator Lemmer is talking about?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, committee members, if you take a look at the bill on line 6.10, on the yellowed copy it's page 5, but it's literally the regular page number. What it says in there is only a provider may access patient identifying information in a record locator service. So the answer is exactly as Senator Olson said, that no, a insurance company would not have access to this information, and only a provider may access it, and then only with the patient's consent. The other protections that would be associated with the record locator service would include that it does require the patient's consent. It's only healthcare providers and no other entities that may access it. A patient may completely opt out of the system if they don't want to be included in the index or card catalog at all. There is a requirement of an audit log that would be need to be maintained as part of that. There's liability associated for any inappropriate disclosures, and any data that would be included in a record locator service would also be protected by any state or federal regulations associated with that type of information. So, for example, one of the organizations we would anticipate probably would choose not to participate in a record locator service would be a substance abuse treatment facility because of the additional federal requirements associated with consent issues around those issues.
So at the clinic that your mother goes to, she'll automatically be put in electronic records files for her clinic, but she'll be given a permission notice on whether or not she would like her biographical information to be put into the locator service, and she could choose to say no. And at each of the other places that she goes to, she could say, yeah, you can put my information into the clinic's electronic system, but I don't want to be in the service. She could presumably say no to all of those clinics putting her information in the locator service. Is that true?
That's, Madam Chair, that's not exactly how the bill is written. I don't want to mischaracterize that. The bill as it stands today would allow providers to put their indices into a record locator service for any health exchange that they're participating in. However, no one else that's participating with them in that health information exchange would be able to access that information until they've obtained the patient's consent. So the information can go into a record locator service, and the reason that that could go without consent is I believe the theory is today, as long as no one is accessing it and the provider is a participant, part owner of that record locator service, that it is not at that point yet a disclosure.
So I show up at my doctor's clinic, and they said that, you know, we're going to go to the record locator service to get this information about you. And I said, oh, no, I do not want any of my information in the record locator service. At that point, that clinic then will go in and wipe out all of my indices that are in the record locator service?
Madam Chair, committee members, that's exactly correct. The easiest way to look at that would be on line 622 of the bill, which talks about a record locator service needs to have a mechanism that allows the patient to opt out. And then on line 624, it talks about the minimum that would be required. So at that point, any consent form that permits the provider to access it must include a checkbox option that allows the patient to completely opt out of the service. And you'll also notice that it says that that checkbox must be clearly displayed to the patient.
One last question, and I think I want Senator Olson to do her amendments, because at any point they could get called to a committee. Can you talk to us a little bit about who is going to own the record locator service, and how far along are things in the development, kind of the logistics of the development of the record locator service?
Yes, the owners of the record locator service would be the participants in a health information exchange. And I believe we worked with Senate Counsel on a definition of that. What a health information exchange really is, it's a legal arrangement between healthcare entities that enable and oversee the business and legal issues associated with the electronic exchange of health information. And so, therefore, for example, if you had three organizations that were going to form an exchange, those three organizations would be the owner of that record locator service.
Hang on a second. Let's pass out the A9 amendment.
What kind of organization? I'm sorry, ma'am.
We're going to pass out the A9 amendment so you
can
see that.
May I ask what kind of organizations you're talking about? Are you talking about a hospital and its clinics that are part of its system, or define organization, I guess.
Yes, the organizations would be healthcare entities. So the people who would be participating would be primarily providers. There would be other people who could be participating. For example, a group purchaser, which would be a payer of healthcare, could participate. And the reason is they would have data that would be very useful to the treatment of the patient. The best example of that would be medication histories. If you want to know a patient's medication history, the best place to request that information is actually from the payer, because the payer would have the complete log of not only what was prescribed, but actually what was filled through the pharmacy, whereas most of the providers would not be very decentralized. So you could have other healthcare entities such as that participating, though they would not be able to get access to the record locator service, nor would they be able to get access to patient records without consent, just as they'd have today.
Madam Chair, we need to go sign our conference committee report.
And then you come back.
Can we do that and come back?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We'll hold off for that. Mr. Goldman, in the amendment you talk about, and by the way, this language in the amendment came from, I think, input from the department. Talk about a legal arrangement between healthcare entities. And then in the definition, you talk about related healthcare entity. Is it the same? Is the health information exchange between related healthcare entities, or are they two separate? groups of people that you're thinking about here?
Madam Chair, they would be two separate groups of people. The term related healthcare entity is an existing term in statute, and what it essentially, it actually is not defined. It's used in the statute today in 144.335, but it is not defined. What the definition, what we're doing here is putting definition around it, and we're putting the common usage, which in the common usage today, a related healthcare entity is someone that's under either common ownership or if it's a nonprofit, under common control. And the purpose of that is really because those organizations, a related healthcare entity, can share information within their legal entity
already.
Without consent already.
Already.
So when we say entities here, we mean really kind of more the traditional legal sense of separate legal entities. So for example, you could have Hospital A, Clinic B, and Laboratory C forming an exchange. Perhaps maybe the most clear-cut example would be in a rural setting where you have one hospital and three clinics. In order to make sure that they're able to appropriately share information about patients who might present at any of those three entities, the three clinics and the hospital would form an exchange that would allow them to exchange information electronically.
Well, I would ask you to reconsider using the word entity. It's too closely resembling your definition of related healthcare entity. I think it would create some confusion. You might want to say healthcare providers or healthcare. I mean, some other word, I think, other than entities would be helpful. And I understand that your definition of related healthcare entity is the same as the definition of what is an affiliate. So if a health-related entity means an affiliate, and an affiliate means an entity that controls or is controlled by, which is your definition, why is it a need for an affiliate and a related healthcare entity to define the same thing? Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, to your last point, this was just a draft, the way it was drafted. We worked with counsel, we talked to counsel. I think the reason for keeping the term related healthcare entity is that it is used in statute today and is common language within the industry. I think to your point, I don't think we would have any concerns saying related healthcare entity has the definition of an affiliate in section and moving forward with that.
And then just delete affiliate, right?
Yeah, I don't think that changes the meaning of the two in combination.
So Senator Lima moves to delete line 1.11 and 1.12, and the rest of the number be, the rest of the section be renumbered. Senator Betzel, on the bill. Senator Betzel, is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Or Senator Betzel, do you want to move that?
I'll move it. Senator Lima was asking if this is on the amendment. It's on the bill, just deleting the term affiliate, since it would not really be needed here.
I think we have to define affiliate here. In the sense of means, I think we have to put the definition here.
That's right.
So the entity means has the same meaning as affiliate in section.
And then on line 2.25, you will do the cross reference. Cross reference section 144.6521, subdivision 3, paragraph B. Council will do that. Will you incorporate that, Senator Betzel?
Yeah, I will.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair? Senator, my question that I had on healthcare entities or however we choose to define them, I've often wondered, and this is kind of an abstract question, but with this modification in law, could a provider of a particular pharmaceutical get names of customers in order to promote their product to the individual accessing identifiable information?
Madam Chair.
Would it fit in any type of definition that we're talking about?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no, they would not be able to get that. Those types of uses of the data would be, in our view, prohibited both under Minnesota statute, but certainly under the HIPAA privacy regulations, that type of activity would be prohibited without the patient's explicit consent. So both state and federal law would prohibit that.
I'm sure.
Senator Limmer,
there seems to be a reality out in the public that individuals have come to me saying that they don't have any, they've never given permission to release any of their medical records, and yet they keep getting advertisements in the mail to them specifically promoting a particular pharmaceutical that would be directed toward the medical condition that they have. And they've never quite figured out how or who gets that information to be used for commercial purposes, but nevertheless, it happens. And I'm always concerned about data privacy when it comes to selling of products, especially when a doctor isn't promoting that particular brand of whatever it is, and then all of a sudden a competitor is saying, ask your doctor about the new Vioxx or whatever it is that they're promoting. And I'm just wondering, I'm hoping that we are creating unintended opportunities in this. And this is a lot of material to swallow, but in your opinion, is there anything that would cause any type of release of that information?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no, there is nothing that we are doing in this bill that would expand any of the ability under either state or federal law to do those kinds of activities. This bill is really focused on trying to find ways to move information between healthcare providers for the treatment of the patients that they're seeing, and only for those purposes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer,
there was another reference that you made when it came to the reference on page 6, lines 22 through 26. This is about the opt-out for patients. A record locator service must provide a mechanism for patients to opt out. How would a person know what an RLS is in the first place when they get this checkbox option? How do we inform the public that there is such a thing, and is there a procedure here in this proposal that does that?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think one of the benefits of this section on the minimum is that it has to be part of a consent. As part of providing a patient consent, all of the healthcare organizations, providers that we dealt with, understand that informed consent means there needs to be at least some education of the patient. So as part of asking for the consent, I'm asking for your consent to be able to access this thing called a record locator service. This is what it is. This is what I'm able to do with it. As part of that education, that would be part of the consent, would also be part of the opt-out, because they would be on one and the same.
Now, Madam Chair, when one goes through the exercise of educating an individual, isn't it? Is it really an opt-out or is it an opt-in?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think it depends at which point. It's clearly an opt-in because the patient must provide consent for the patient to access that information. So again, no provider can access the information without the patient's consent. So from that aspect, it's clearly an opt-in. With the ability to create the record locator, providers can do that. They can create the actual database that would be queried without the patient's consent, but the patient has the ability to opt out of that. So, I mean, I guess it depends on which point you're looking at.
Now, at a time when they have multiple visits to a clinic, or perhaps different clinics, will they be asked that every time they go to a clinic or a different clinic? Or is it one time, and then that's for the life of the customer relationship with that particular clinic?
Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the patient would be asked for a consent at each of the providers who would be looking to access that. By provider would need to do that. In the bill as it's written, that would be until revoked. Some organizations have a routine policy of just obtaining every consent on a one-year basis just to make sure they don't miss it. If they would choose to put this in, I'm not sure they might, but it would be until revoked. The statute would allow until revoked.
I'm sure.
Solomon.
I'm thinking part of this bill is to create a uniformity. And I would think that perhaps the sequence of allowing the customer to, or the patient to know what their rights are as far as an opt-out, should be something that would be uniform between services as well as providers, so that one provider isn't working out of uniformity with another, and that if our concern is really the giving the best option to patients, that I go in to a medical doctor maybe once every 18 years for a checkup, and I don't know what the rules are and how they change. And as I'm getting older, my wife certainly tells me I should go in more often than that. And so I need to know as a patient what my rights are, and I think uniformity is important. Now, if it's true, by the last testimony we just heard, that maybe providers have their own way of setting up their own policies, then I'm a little concerned about that.
Well, Mr. Golden, the A9 amendment has not been offered yet, so I want the other members to have an opportunity to look at that. I did pass to Senator Betzel and Mr. Golden the A7 amendment, which is a technical amendment that I wanted them to look at. And I think that on that one, we could probably move on that one. Senator Betzel, Mr. Golden, can you?
Madam Chair, I've had an opportunity to look at it as Mr. Golden. It does appear to be quite technical. It just provides, after the provider as defined in 144.291 in a couple of sections, and then it refers to the representation consent has to be signed and dated and actually authorizing the release. I think that that's fine.
Okay. Senator Limmer, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I'll move the A7 amendment.
All right. All those in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposing, say no. The motion prevails. Mr. Golden, I think you were on your way to answering my question about where the development was, and we went to the health information exchange. Is it the department's intention to help develop some forms and formats and rules and regulations to kind of govern the creation of the health information exchanges and the record locator services, or is this it? What's in statute?
Madam Chair, the central body that the legislature has created is the Minnesota eHealth Advisory Committee, which brings together a wide variety of stakeholders from providers, plans, consumers, technical expertise, the University of Minnesota. So there's 26 members that sit on that. That is the kind of the main advisory body for the Commissioner of Health and the legislature regarding the recommendations on how to proceed in a coherent, collaborative fashion as a state, both for private entities and public entities. So we do anticipate one of the other portions of this project that generated the suggested changes and modifications to the patient consent requirements also did something that was working on security principles around authorizing, how do you authorize people who would be part of a health information exchange, how do you authenticate them, how do you develop access controls within the systems that are created, and then how do you develop auditing standards. Generally speaking, these aren't legal issues in the sense of statutory issues. though they would be, of course, issues that would be covered by things such as the HIPAA security regulations. And I think what we have been trying to do through the eHealth Advisory Committee and some of the work groups that are working on this is to try to find ways to address the security issues that are common or uniform across the different types of organizations that are trying to develop health information exchanges, so that at some point we're not all doing things differently. I think the development of health information exchanges and record locator services are at various spots, and I would say that they're very local in nature at this point. So, for example, there's a great interest actually in the rural area of trying to connect up hospitals with their clinics that might feed patients into that hospital. And one of the reasons is patients will often present in the emergency room in a non-emergency situation in after hours. And the provider, the physician that's in the emergency room, in order to treat that patient, would really like to be able to have some access to the patient's record at those clinics. Clinic isn't open. Patient's more than willing to consent. There's just no physical way to get those documents sent over. So those are examples of organizations that are very much looking at doing this. In the metro area, we have a number of larger organizations that are looking at trying to find ways to exchange information in very select situations. So, for example, when someone presents in the emergency room, what they would like to be able to do is to be able to exchange medication histories explicitly. And they've limited to that because there are good standards for being able to exchange that information. And they would be, you know, very far along in the development of a record locator service. Organizations are developing these because they have to have some way within an exchange of trying to understand where the records are.
Well, so if this this passes, and if it's in the omnibus budget bill, Health Human Services budget bill, it'll have an effective date of July 1, presumably, unless we explicitly state August. Presumably, what this then will go back to this e-records working group, and the e-records group working group would take a look at some of these issues and would be issuing some recommendations to the commissioner on how to begin implementation of the creation of the record locator services and the exchanges. Is that the next step, Roland?
Madam Chair, that would be one of the next steps. Yes, in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill, in both the Senate and House position, they're nearly identical. They call for the eHealth Advisory Committee to work on developing a statewide plan for implementing the mandate set by both the Senate and the House for interoperable electronic health records. They call for that committee to take a look at national standards that are being developed for data exchange as well as for security issues so that we can adopt and refine them for use in Minnesota. I would say that certainly what the goal of the eHealth Advisory Committee is to try to coordinate these activities so that it is done in a uniform fashion and that it is done in a way that is protective of patients and provides the ability to get them the better care. I would just point out that there are initiatives of forming health information exchanges going on already. So, for example, there is a great deal of federal funding that is already coming into the state. It's not to state agencies, but to private entities within the state to do pilot projects around these types of projects.
And Mr. Golden, are there federal dollars that are kind of carrots for states to move in this direction where you could get some kind of federal grants to the department if the state passes this kind of statute to move in this direction?
Madam Chair, there are a number of grant programs. The President Bush proposed an increase of $188 million in the federal budget for the Office of the National Coordinator of Health Information Technology. That is within the federal agencies, the agency that is responsible for kind of coordinating this at a federal level. They have put out a number of grants. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has provided a number of grants, usually about $3 million per grant, Minnesota has been the recipient of at least one, if not two, of those already. Additionally, there are a number of proposals. Well, there's also grants that are available through the National Office of the Rural Health. Well, it's the Office of the National Rural Health. I forget the exact title. But they also have grants that would be dedicated to rural providers, particularly hospitals and critical access hospitals. So there is a great deal of federal money that is coming in around these issues.
And Mr. Goldman, after, if this does become law and the e-records group get together, will people like Ms. Neumeister and Ms. Twyla Brace have an opportunity to give input as we move forward to think about the security piece of how you actually implement something like this?
Madam Chair, absolutely. All of those activities are public meetings that are held, and there is a website which announces those. Currently, we have over 1,000. We maintain a list of interested individuals. The list currently has over 1,000 individuals that would receive an email about all of the meetings, as well as any of the materials that are going to be discussed at those meetings. And all of the materials are published 1 week before the meetings.
Senator Betzel, can you look at the A9 amendment to see what you think about that definition of health information exchange? Senator Lemmer, can you look at that and see what you think about that?
Madam Chair, we've had a suggestion that instead of using the word entities, if we used providers and group purchasers, that might be better.
Yep.
Madam Chair, what's a group purchaser?
Mr. Goldman?
Well, Madam Chair, the definition, I believe, if it's not, it's simply a cross-reference. Essentially, a group purchaser is a payer of health insurance. So it would be an HMO, it would be an insurer, it would be, perhaps Senate Council might have 62J available.
It's defined, page one of the bill, it says group purchaser has the meaning of 62J.03. We have some language suggested to us that, as I say, providers and group purchasers, since they're both part of this bill.
Well, I don't know if we want to put group purchasers in here, because I thought group purchasers weren't eligible, really, to get access to this type of information. From Senator Limmer's concerns about health insurance companies being able to query about who's enrolling in their health care plans. Mr. Goldman?
Madam Chair, committee members, no, I think that Senator Limmer's concern is a very valid concern. Allowing a group purchaser to be a participant, a member of a health information exchange, does not allow them access to the data. It does allow them to contribute data or allow them to have their records queried or accessed. And the best example of where that would be very beneficial is when you're in the emergency room and the physician wants to find out your medication history. The best place to do that would be through the pharmacy benefit manager of your health plan. So the health plans have an interest in allowing providers to be able to access that information, because it's going to make sure that the patient is getting the best care, because you're much less likely to have a drug that is counterindicated or would otherwise interact with one of the other drugs. The definition just says who can actually participate, not who can exchange the data. That's actually requiring the consent of the patient.
Senator Lemmer.
Could an insurer then know the pharmaceutical history of a patient?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, when they pay for the pharmaceuticals, they would have that information already. And I think that's the reason that they would be participating, is because that would be a source of a type of health record. So the answer is yes, they already have that information.
So could they exchange that information with others?
Madam Chair, Senator Limerick, today and under this bill, they could not exchange that information with others without the patient's consent. There would be both 144.335 that prohibits that, Chapter 79A would prohibit that, as well as, depending on the purpose of the exchange, HIPAA privacy regulations would prohibit that as well.
Madam Chair, is there any consequence in the event that they did? I would imagine that if you knew what type of drug or pharmaceutical that a patient might be taking, you would know that the existing condition that patient may have. Is there any consequence in this particular bill if that was revealed?
Madam Chair, Senator Limerick, yes, there are consequences for releasing a patient's health record without the patient's consent. And depending on who releases it, if it's a provider, they would be subject to disciplinary action from their licensing board or agency. They would also be liable for compensatory damages plus costs and reasonable attorney's fees. And that is both of those issues are existing law. Those would be the same as they are today.
Senators Olson and Foley and Neville and now Senator Higgins, we have just passed out the A9 amendment, and the A9 amendment is an opportunity to, I think you were here when we passed that out, to define what a health information exchange is. And so we're just going over that definition of health information exchange. And the change that Senator Betzel has added to that is on line 1.4, delete entity and insert providers and group purchasers. So that would read, health information exchange means a legal arrangement between healthcare providers and group purchasers to enable, and the rest of the sentence. Any questions to Senator Betzel on the A9 amendment to define that?
Is there anyone in the audience that would want to make comment about this amendment?
Anybody want to comment on health information exchange, that definition, Mr. Neumeister?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Neumeister. The issue for me is what the definition of health information exchange is going to relate to, just RLS or primarily this of medical records. One of the concerns I have is using group purchasers. Employers, like through ERISA and all that, could probably get access to some kinds of information. And then when layoff time comes around or other kinds of issues may happen, when you talk about some of that discrimination issues or whatever, you may be one of the first folks to go. That's one of the concerns I have. And also as part of the RLS, there was an amendment in here that was done in the House that basically said that group purchasers, and I can't see it right offhand, would not have access to that RLS data, where you go, where, you know, what providers you've been to. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are some of the concerns I have and how broad how this health information proposal comes into play, even with the general consent of where information goes.
Mr. Golden, let's get you back up there. I just want this on the record. I think that where health information exchange is referred to in the bill is only within the context of the RLS. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, committee members, I believe that is correct. That is my understanding as well.
And that is the intent here, is that for the health information exchange to only be formed in the context of the record locator services, not for anything else. Is that true, Mr. Goldman?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yes, that's correct.
Mr. Neumeister, does that take care of it for you, or do you still need specific language? Because I think the statute says that. So I think I'm all right. I think that's okay. Senator Higgins, anyone else? On the A9 amendment, Senator Neville.
I'm still trying to make sure I understand what a health information exchange. There could be many of them. So if you got the Allina system health information exchange and the person goes outside of that system, there'll be no way for another doctor to put their name on the RLS that other one maintains.
Is that correct?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, there will be multiple exchanges. I think when we were talking a little bit earlier, in your example, yes, you might have a situation where perhaps Alliana, Fairview, and Hennepin County Medical Center would like to be able to form an exchange. They would form a record locator services for trying to identify where within their systems they have records about a patient, but only those providers that are in those three systems would be able to access that record locator service.
Chair and Mr. Gold, as a practical matter, do you think there is going to be a single health information exchange in Minnesota ever created so that every single provider can access the same one?
Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think that the answer to that is probably not in the immediate future. I think what's going to happen is there are going to be a number of smaller exchanges that are set up for providers that share common and overlapping patients. One example would be in the rural area, you have a hospital and three clinics. They have a very common population base. They have a need to exchange records because they often see the same patients. Same thing in the metro area. There might be a number of clinics that are feeding into Hennepin County Medical Center from the urban area. They would need to be able to communicate those types of records back and forth.
Madam Chair,
Senator Neville,
the RLS wouldn't affect that at all. I mean, if it's hospital and affiliated clinics, they can have their own agreement and move it around within their own system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the RLS, which is what providers are going to be sending identifying information to. And as I understand the whole purpose of the RLS, it's to make sure you get to complete a picture of a patient's providers as possible, and there are going to be some that are outside of the Northfield Hospital and the three affiliated clinics that it has. Otherwise, it won't do much good. So it strikes me, as I'm trying to get a grasp on how this whole thing works, is that in order for it to work, there's going to have to eventually be a single health information exchange and or a single RLS, isn't there?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I like the idea that we use in the criminal justice side where each entity here would take and keep a data file and the RLS would run through the from one to another without, you know, creating more things.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason CRIMNet works is because there's one in the whole state.
Well, no,
there's
no.
Backbone.
No.
There are bunches.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair, we're kind of doing. But there are a lot of databases included in the one CRIMNet network.
But the three have been spending a lot of time together
in
the public safety budget bill, and they've become a little bit informal in that process.
$5,485,000 on CRIMNet.
Right. Well, let's do this. Any questions on the A9 amendment? Senator Limmer.
On this last discussion, I don't see why we would even do this unless the goal is not to create a single RLS. Our world is too complex, and there's too many disciplines that reflect different clinics. I can't imagine that we would be creating this for a series of different medical systems that already can share some of this information within their own corporation or their affiliates, or even make arrangements at the bequest of the patient to send records back and forth. Ultimately, I can't see how it can go any other way, and that we're starting this evolution toward maybe today it's little pockets or assorted RLSs, but now it'll eventually get to be one central data bank of holding all of the information. And we may only be, for the purposes of this discussion, we're only talking of what we can do in the state. This could even go more national in a different perspective as well, because our world is complex. We have people that retire, they live in Florida in the winter, they live in Minnesota the summer. They're moving all around. They go to different disciplines. Some people want to go down to Texas and get a certain cancer treatment, whereas it's not available here. So there's all sorts of things. This could just expand beyond our wildest imaginations of restraint. And once that happens, then how do you apply state law to protect anyone's data in the first place? And so I think what we're creating is the absolute and real potential of making, at least for the purposes here, one central data collector.
Senator Betzel.
Well, I don't think it's too far of a stretch to think that at some point in time, just because of efficiencies, you know, business practices, and so forth, it could wind up evolving into a single one statewide beyond the state boards and so forth. Let me go back to what I started saying originally, though. You know, we didn't come in here proposing that hospitals and clinics start converting paper records to electronic records. They've already done that. We're not proposing that they start creating a database to identify patient records. They're doing that. We're not even proposing that they think about trying to find a way to do that. They've already thought about that, and they're going that direction. The question is, do we want to have a say in how that's done, or do we let the system start evolving, and then we try to catch up to them? I think it's better to try to figure out that this is what they're doing, and this is where they're going, and to try to have us set the ground rules as opposed to them designing the system, which they may even be doing today.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I agree with everything that you just said, Senator Betzel, and I think, and even more than that, I can just share from my own personal experience. I was telling Senator Foley, just in the last year, I lost a sister who might be here today if we had had a national records exchange. She had 6 suicide attempts within a year, and was treated at a number of different facilities who told us after the fact that if they had known about her earlier attempts, they might very well have not allowed her to leave. And so the lack of that kind of communication probably made it more difficult for her to get the treatment that she really needed. So I see the benefit to this type of thing for medical purposes, and I see the benefit to this type of thing from a cost-effective, just efficiency of medical, providing medical services. But all of that being said, I think we have to be really careful. And I don't know that the laws that we have in place that have been very protective of people's privacy, both at the federal and state law, are any different. Those laws shouldn't be treated any differently whether we're talking about paper records or electronic records. And the very fact that someone has been seen in a facility, the name of that facility and the fact they were there, is part of their medical record that's private. And so as we set up this type of a registry, it seems to me that it's important that we follow the rules that are consistent with the laws we already have in place for paper records. And I think we could do that simply by making sure that the person has to deliver an authorization to the place that's going to be releasing it electronically or however they would do that, or that they, at the time they're seen, they simply give that authorization at the time to that facility, saying it's okay to put this information on the RLS. And then I also think it's important that we limit this use for medical purposes only, and we don't inadvertently or indirectly allow this to become a tool that's used for employment screening or credit screening or those other kinds of purposes. So I think there is definitely a good use for this, but I think we have to set it up in a way that's consistent with other laws.
Members, we've got a ton of amendments to get through, so let's keep our comments. If you have an issue, then let's change the bill or vote down the bill. But I got to get down to the Tax Conference Committee. Senator Higgins.
I was just going to say, all the folks representing the health plans back around there could probably tell us the hundreds of millions of dollars that they have already spent putting their electronic medical records systems together. And this horse is out of the barn. And we need to bring our state law into compliance with the way the world is now, not the way it was when, you know, Senator Merriam was senator, and they probably just were learning about pagers. Maybe didn't even have cell phones yet. But I agree with you. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just would like us to get down the road on this. So I'm going to follow on the A9 amendment.
Quick question, Madam Chair. I get prescriptions filled at Walgreens, and Walgreens, you can pick up anywhere. There are three or four places in Anoka, for instance, and there are one. But they must have a deal that allows you to go anywhere in the country. So maybe there's something there that you could ask somebody to come in and testify for the Walgreens to tell us how they do that.
Well, the only difference is, Madam Chair, is that the patient allows them to through consent.
Well, yeah, you of course need to get that to get your drug.
They don't have a RLS where without consent your data goes to.
If anybody here represents Walgreens, or anybody represents Walgreens, can we have them come talk to Senator Foley? The A9 amendment on the I think this is a technical amendment. We felt like the health information exchange was referred throughout the bill, and I think it's just good to have that definition also included in the bill. So on the A9 amendment, Senator Betzel has moved the A9 amendment.
Did we change entities, though, or is it just
yes? Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And Senator Betzel will incorporate deletion of entities and insert providers and group purchasers. All those in favor of the A9 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Members who came back, we adopted the A7 technical amendment, which is just a cross-reference to further to make more clearly what provider was referring to, and then actually three cross-references. And then on page 4, line 30, we made it more clear that the consent would be signed and dated, and that it would be authorizing the release of the information. So that amendment has been adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Maybe we should just hand out all the amendments. So,
let's do this in an orderly fashion. Where's the past, present, future amendment?
Oh,
to keep it there. And then what is this one takes? Sorry. Let's see. There's an A11 amendment. Yes. The A11 amendment. Senator Neville and Senator Betzel have both been alerted to the A11 amendment, which is the liability section. Senator Betzel, have you seen it? Can somebody get a copy of the A11 amendment to Senator Betzel? This is the allocation of liability section on page 10. When I first saw this language, I thought it was rather unusual, but I wanted to make sure that Senator Betzel and Senator Neville and other members have, you know, had a chance to take a look at it. Senator Betzel, any response to the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, you and I had discussed it, that the bill language in the bill sort of directs the court how to apportion liability and, you know, what factors to consider. And that's a little bit unusual. We normally don't prescribe that to judges. You know, we normally just say, if you do something, you're liable. Here's some consequences. You know, we try to set that out. So I'm reading through the A11 amendment right now, but I certainly agree with you that what's currently in the bill is just a little bit more prescriptive than what we typically do. But I'm just reading it through right now. So.
Well, while you wait, Ms. Pontius, can you talk a little bit about the language in the A11 amendment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, basically what this does is take the liability language from current law and restate it in a new spot in this bill. So all these provisions are taken out of liability in current law.
Senator Lemmer?
I'm trying to get an understanding of compensatory damages. Would that be compensatory means to compensate?
for damages or loss. I could see where someone who would intentionally give a person's health records out without their permission could hurt someone more than just compensatory. I talked with Senator Betzel. We didn't have much of a discussion about it, but is there or could there be an application for punitive damages? Let's take, for example, a person who may have maybe an AIDS victim, and word gets out that he's got AIDS in some communities, and there's far more damage done than just what compensatory damages could be addressed. And I'm wondering if the committee would consider punitive damages as well.
Ms. Pondy, is under other sections of the law, under the scenario that Senator Limmer has laid out, can that individual get other types of damages elsewhere?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not sure if this is the language from the current statute. I don't know if the punitive damage issue has ever come up in a lawsuit. If you just say damages, I know courts will allow punitive damages to be awarded. But if you say compensatory, I think that would be considered limiting and therefore would exclude it. Mm-hmm. But I haven't researched that issue.
Madam Chair, is the courts restricted by this language? Would they be restricted by our direction, or could they go forward with punitive damages beyond what we give them direction on?
Senator Neville?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have a statute on punitive damages that I don't think this language would prevent somebody from claiming and recovering punitive damages. It's just a different burden of proof. You've got to prove clear and convincing evidence and a few other things. This compensatory damages, as I understand it, could be general or special. So special damages would be something like out-of-pocket. General damages could be hurt, you know, stress, intentional infliction of emotional distress, basically anything else that's not out-of-pocket.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Neville, if the attorney chooses to, they could seek the punitive by showing the fact pattern that would lead to that. That answered. Does that answer your question? I think so. Senator Neville, what do you think of this restoring this new language to this section?
Madam Chair, I think it clarifies things a lot to do it this way. I'm just wondering, when I'm looking at Paragraph 2 on line 1.6, whether that's duplicative, it forges a signature, because isn't that already covered under the sections? I don't think it hurts anything to keep it in there, so maybe it's better just to keep it in there.
Senator Betzel or Mr. Golden, any reactions?
Just one comment, further clarification on line 5 of the A11 amendment. It says somebody who negligently or intentionally releases a health record. I think that we should say requests or releases one. I mean, I don't think if somebody, you know, violates the law, they could violate it by requesting it. They may not get the information, but if they request it, mm-hmm. violation of the law, they should be held accountable whether they get the information or not. So requests or releases the information.
That will be incorporated into the amendment. Senator Betzel, do you want to move this amendment? Senator Betzel has moved the A11 amendment. Anybody in the audience want to speak to this amendment? Any member in the committee want to further question this amendment? Mr. Golden, are you... I know that this is different from your language, but I think that we took a look at it and we felt like the language is a little bit too prescriptive, and this really tightens it up. So, very good. All those in favor of the A11 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Let's see, Ms. Pontius, what else do we have? Let's see, on the A8 amendment, Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair and members, this was, at least, and I apologize, the department hasn't had it, and Senator Betzel haven't seen this yet. This is basically kind of a rewriting of the record locator subdivision to try to make it clear.
Let's pass it on, and you can walk us through it. I think from the testimony, we have an idea of what the intention is behind Subdivision 8 in terms of spelling out the mechanics of how the record gets into the record locator service, how people have access to it, how the information comes out, what kind of consent is given, and to whom the consent is given. And I've asked Ms. Pontius to redraft Subdivision 8 to just make it more sequential and easier to read and easier to understand. And so maybe once we've had a look at it, you might think not. But I think that the rewrite will make it a little clearer, so it doesn't take so much effort to try to understand what it is that we're trying to do. Because I think Subdivision 8 is really the crux of what this bill is trying to do. So, Ms. Pontius, why don't you walk us through?
Madam Chair, members, it follows pretty closely. I'll just point out a few differences. The first sentence that is sort of the general provision that authorizes providers to, you know, put information in this locator service without consent. It just adds a clarifying cross-reference, I think, that unless the patient has elected to be excluded from the service under paragraph D.
Mr. Golden, is that accurate?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is.
Because once I've said no to one clinic, that information will be communicated to somehow, so that then my later visits don't get put into the system. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay, Ms. Pontius.
And Madam Chair, the next sentence is basically just moved up from a later part in that paragraph in current law. And then the next sentence is almost identical, except on line 10, the current draft says, until the patient specifically consents, and I thought it was better just to say, unless the patient specifically consents.
Means the same.
I think so. It's just
important. Does that relationship go into perpetuity then?
No. The next sentence.
Okay. What line?
Line 11. Consent does not expire, but may be revoked by the patient at any time by providing written notice of the revocation to the provider. Mr. Golden, is that consistent with what you have previously?
Madam Chair, it's very consistent.
Okay.
And then, Madam Chair, I think all paragraph B, I think, is pretty much identical to what's in the bill right now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
On that thing we just went by on line 11, what I would like in there would be something that would pick up the case where an individual consented and then withdrew his consent, telling the holder there that he no longer wants to be in there.
Mr. Golden, I think it's implied, but you can consent and then at some point in the future revoke that consent, right?
That's true, but what happens to the data that is coming back? There's nothing that says they must turn the thing back in or destroy the, if it's electronic storage and so on.
So you consent, and 5 years on the road you revoke, you withdraw your consent. You want them to go back and delete all the records from 5 years ago up to the current time? Senator Foley?
Yes, I do.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville?
I mean, you can put it.
They wouldn't be destroying records. They'd be destroying identifying information in the RLS.
You know, or the Senator Neville, the record will continue to be in existence, but nobody can have access to it.
Yeah.
I think, right?
Well, if that's the way you end up with
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, obviously, I mean, if you give your consent and you revoke the consent, that's one thing. But if you're talking 5 years down the road, I think that what you'd be doing is opting out, saying, take my name and my identifying information out
opt
of this
out.
Locator service, which is what's dealt with later on.
Okay.
I don't think you'd directly revoke your consent. You just say, take me out of the database, which has the same effect.
Okay. Ms. Pontius, continue.
Madam Chair, members, paragraph B, I believe, and C are identical to what's in the bill right now. Under paragraph D on line 22 of the amendment, and this is one we did discuss with the department. Right now, it states that a record locate service must provide a mechanism, and it seemed more appropriate to put that responsibility on the provider or the entity operating the service to provide the opt-out mechanism. And then it also, instead of using the term opt-out, it just actually more explicitly states what an opt-out is, which is what the patient may exclude their information from the service rather than opting out of the service. It does, and then also instead of referring to a box being clearly displayed on line 26, refers to a conspicuous checkbox option.
This is on the consent form.
Senator Lemmer?
This checkbox option is to be located on the consent form.
This would be at the, so they would get this at the point where they're actually asking for a consent to get access to data in the service.
Are we creating a uniform consent form in law?
Mr. Golden, this paragraph D would lead to some suggestions, I'm assuming, a development of a form from the group that will. It would lead to some kind of uniform form that will be used, or elements that will be included in a form that would kind of be uniform throughout the state. Is that the intention here?
Madam Chair, committee members, we haven't gotten to that point in our discussions with the advisory group. I would say that with it, for any record locator, all of the providers that are using that would undoubtedly use a very similar or identical consent or opt-out for that, probably.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I have to say I'm a little confused by this paragraph D in terms of how this will work, because it seems like the provider who has a particular record is the one that's going to put the information that they have the record up onto the system. And the person who's requesting the records is going to be requesting those or giving the consent is going to be giving that consent to a different provider in a different location, theoretically. And how is that person going to take the information off the system dealing with someone else's records? It seems like the request to remove the records should go to the facility that has those records rather than having someone else have the authority to get that person's name off the system. And I wonder if there isn't a way for a person...
Mr. Golden, answer that question. Mr. Golden, can you answer that question?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. A record locator service is part of a health information exchange. In the definition that we just adopted, a health information exchange is a legal arrangement between a number of provider organizations. So what the provider, once you opt out, you're giving that provider a form that says, I want to be taken totally out of the record locator. They would simply just pass that to the record locator, and the record locator would remove them from that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, but couldn't we somehow just give the person the ability to make specific records not a part of the system, rather than just wholesale opting in or out? If there's a particular record that person doesn't think is relevant and they don't want someone else to have access to it, they don't want it in the locator system, to be able to go back to that facility and say, I don't want you to put your name on my general record. I want my doctor to be able to find out about all my other healthcare records, but I don't want them to know, or my dentist to know about this one particular record. And I don't want to have to fill out a form with my dentist that says I don't want him to look at my mental health record because I don't even want him to know it exists. Can't we somehow make it allow them the opportunity to have some control over that directly with the person that has the record?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it may do that right now in the language. You know, as an example, say if somebody has had chemical dependency treatment at Hazelden, and they just don't want people to know that, but all the other medical information is correct. So on the locator service, take anything about Hazelden out. Well, lines 22 to 24 say a provider or entity operating record must provide a mechanism under which patients may exclude their identifying information and information about the location of their health records from a record locator service. I would read that to say that if I want to exclude some information.
Okay, thank you.
You know, and that could be done. So, you know, you could, okay, take out the Hazelden references, the rest is okay. I don't see that as reading all or none, but that's just how I'm reading it. Perhaps other members of the committee might see it differently.
Madam Chair?
Sarah Higgins?
Maybe since they haven't put this uniform consent form together yet, that's an option that the study group can work on. It's how to exclude specific pieces of data. I think that's something that the working group is fully capable of dealing with.
Mr. Golden, you've been here and you understand the issue that we've raised with respect to this section. And so will you make sure that that concern and ambiguity is raised? And just so that the members of the committee will know, it is my intention to get a report back from the department on how this is going. We have ongoing concerns about the data privacy issues here, and this is not the last time we're going to revisit the forms and how the data operates. So we'll get that information back. Senator Neville.
Chair, Mr. Gould, who can operate an RLS other than a health information exchange?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, essentially no one. It's just that what we wanted to make sure is that if they form some type of legal arrangement, a nonprofit or an LLC, that they would be clearly covered by this. So it was just to make sure that any legal arrangement or a vendor who was doing it on their behalf was absolutely covered as under this.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not comfortable.
Senator Neville.
On line 13, it says a health information exchange maintaining an RLS or an entity maintaining an RLS. That suggests something broader than just a health information exchange.
Senator Neville, you want to move to strike or an entity?
Yes. Well, more than that.
Yeah, and then the next line, maintaining?
Yeah.
A record locator service?
Yes.
I think that will make it more clear. That will be incorporated into the A8 amendment. Senator Higgins moves the A8 amendment. Any discussions? I don't think there's substantive changes other than that language. It's just reworking it to make it more clear. Any questions, members? Any further questions on the A8 amendment? Senator Betzel?
Fine.
All right. All those in favor of the A8 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
I believe those are all the amendments that have been prepared.
There were some concerns raised about the representation of a consent. And so if members want to talk about that, we could. And then I believe there's that one issue, and then I believe Senator Olson has one other issue. Members, I really like to get us out of here by 5 o'clock. Senator Betzel has to get his conference committee going. I need to get down to taxes. So, Senator Olson, do you, I understand you have an amendment. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, we should note again, the A7 amendment did amend, you're referring to page 430 and 31, the A7 amendment did add the word signed and dated before the word consent and then before the period authorized the release. So we've already had an amendment to that section. So.
Yes.
Yes, Senator Higgins.
What does a representation from a provider that a provider holds a consent from the patient mean? Is that a fax? Is that a copy of something? Is that a what?
Could be just Mr.
Golden.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins. Actually, a representation, I actually agree with Mr. Neumeister's simply looking it up in the dictionary. The manifestation to another that a fact exists. I think what's likely to happen in an electronic environment is all of the individuals who have access to that are required to have unique logins so that all of their activities can be tracked within the system. So, for example, when a particular provider makes a representation electronically to another provider that they have the consent for what they're asking for, that will then go to that provider saying, basically it's a statement that says, I have the consent for the information I'm requesting for this patient. And then that disclosing provider would document that information.
Senator Lamar.
If I could bring us back to the A8 amendment, I had one question. I did raise the question about whether or not a consent goes into perpetuity, but there's no reference to what a revocation timeline would be. Can a revocation expire, or can it expire if the revocation is reversed by the patient? And I don't know if that needs to be addressed or not.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, if you revoke your consent, you've nullified it. So the consent is like it never existed.
Well, say it never did exist in the first place. Then does that go on?
You can't revoke something that didn't exist.
Well, let's say that I just didn't want to share my medical record with anyone. And I made one statement on January 1st of the year. Does that go into perpetuity and no one can share that information?
That's not a revocation.
Okay, a barring of that information.
That's an opting out, isn't it? Is that already covered?
If it's an opt out, then is it going?
It opts out until you over indicated that.
Did you indicate that, Mr. Golden?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. Yes, my understanding would be very consistent with Senator Betzelt's. It does take an affirmative consent in order for the provider to access a record locator. It takes an affirmative consent for a disclosure of a health record between providers. And if at any time those are revoked, they would remain revoked until such time as there was a consent that would permit such exchange.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Gordon, Senator Olson brought up the possibility of whether or not one could do partial revocation versus allowing some records to be shared. We haven't determined that for the purposes of this discussion yet.
Senator Betzel.
I mean, current law, if you want to authorize access to your records, you can authorize as much or as little as you choose to release, and I don't see anything in this bill that changes any of that. If you say, okay, I'll release my MRI, nothing but that. That's all that the facility that has your MRI, your medical records can do. If you say release everything, they can release everything. They have to go by the limits of what you wrote down in the release.
Madam Chair, I would imagine that this checkbox option on this consent form then would create that additional option so that people would know that they could do a partial release of information or a partial revocation of release of that information.
Well, Madam Chair,
that's helpful.
That was in response to a question Sarah Olson had raised, where, and I suggested as I read lines 22-24 of the AAN amendment, if you go to the record locator service and it lists a number of facilities that you've been treated, and you want to redact something out of there and say, take that one facility out, but the rest are okay, I think that can be done in the language here, but as Senator Higgins suggested, maybe that's something that the working group can also go back and revisit to make sure that we understand what the process is there. But I think the language already covers that, saying, I want to take that out, but the rest can stay in. I don't think it's all or nothing.
Members and Mr. Goldman, I think that let's do it. In this day and age, when we go to the grocery store and we use our credit cards, they have a little sign box where you can sign and your electronic signature gets communicated. And I'm thinking, given the technology that we have, if we need a patient to sign the consent to something, wouldn't it be just as easy for the health clinic to present something like that where the patient can just sign it and we can get the signed consent sent over electronically, communicated? And so what I like to do is let's take the representation and consent out, and we'll have the working group look at the electronic technology that will allow people to sign their consent. And if that doesn't work or can't work, come back next session, and we'll put this back in there as a separate bill, and I will carry that bill for you if we need to do that. Okay, Mr. Golden? But I think it raises some concerns that it goes beyond what we're able to deal with in terms of representation, the liability, and what comes along with it. So the A-10 amendment just deletes the representation language. That subdivision 3, and then also delete the representation language that's referenced to on page 7, lines 1 through 6. picks out that information.
Senator Betzel? As I understand the amendment, nothing changes the whole concept that we've been talking about. It's still going to take the patient's consent to go to record locator service. It's still going to take the patient's consent to get the record. However, we get that consent.
Right.
It's just that some
it would have to be a physical manifestation from the patient to the provider now, instead of on the phone or electronic saying that we have a consent over here. We have to send some kind of indication of a consent.
I'm sure if I can just go back to the point you made about signing stuff at the grocery store. That was one of the first questions I had, saying, you know, we're talking about all these electronic records. Yeah. It's still going to take somebody signing a piece of paper to make these things happen.
Right. Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, I think this is a good amendment for now. I would note, though, the federal courts, for example, are all electronic. You can do electronic filings. You can file electronic affidavits and signatures. And they have a system that,
that
keeps it pretty secure. So I think in the future sometime we can do this. Mm-hmm. But it's too hard right now to put it all together.
Senator Neville, will you move the A-10 amendment?
Yes, I will.
Senator Neville moves the A-10 amendment. All those in favor of the A-10 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Olson, I think your amendment is the only one left.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have a number of amendments, and considering the time, I don't think I want to try to offer them all right now. But I am. Let me just say that what they deal with isn't just the Senator Betzold's new language. I went over the entire section and looked at some things that I think are either outdated or unfair to consumers in terms of the cost and availability of the and ease of obtaining access to medical records. But if we were to deal with all these amendments now, I think that would take too much time, and so I'm going to come back next session.
No, Senator Olson.
I'm going to draft a bill that's going to address all of these issues. But there is one I'd like for this committee to consider, because it relates to an issue that has been raised during our discussion, and that has to do with the uniformity of a request form for medical records. What I've seen happen in practice right now is that everyone
is that, Senator Olson. So
this is the A3.
The A3 amendment.
What I've seen happen in general practice right now is that almost every health facility has their own form that they've come up with that they feel meets HIPAA and state law requirements. And unless a patient uses their specific form, a lot of times they'll deny the records. And there's a lot of confusion about what's required on that form, and it's a lot of difficulties when patients need to get records from a variety of different locations, and they continue to get denials back because they haven't satisfied that particular facility. So what this amendment does is it directs the Department of Health to develop a form that is going to be can be universally used by patients and must be accepted by a provider as satisfying all of the HIPAA requirements. And if this particular form is used by a patient, then it has to be honored by the facility. And I think that we might even want to change this language somewhat to include these requests if we're going to, or maybe that would be something for a future day. But the idea is to have a uniform form. Facilities can still use their own forms if they want to, but if they get one of these uniform forms, they have to honor it. And I have discussed this with the Department of Health. They've assured me that although they're sure that there'll be a lot of discussion about this, it can be done. And I think, I hope I'm not overstepping to say that I don't think I'm the only one that recognizes the value in having a uniform form for ease of access.
Senator Betzel?
Well, and I'll let Mr. Golden speak on for the department. It's right, you know, there may be a fiscal cost here. If there is, the department's going to have to figure that out rather quickly and let Senator Berglund know about that. I guess I share Senator Olson's frustration. Sometimes, you know, one entity will drop a release of information, a consent form, and so forth. Somebody won't honor it. I don't know that this is going to solve everything, though, because even if the health department promulgates a form, you know, some private entity may say, well, we know that's the health department form, but here's ours we want you to sign. So I don't know that it's going to solve all the problems. It would be nice. I don't know, but I don't know if Mr. Golden's got something from his agency he can offer.
Mr. Golden, any thoughts?
Madam Chair, committee members, we did have a preliminary discussion around this issue at the eHealth Advisory Committee. At that point, they weren't ready to move forward on this issue. As we talked with Senator Olson, I think there would be a lot of discussion. I'm not quite sure how difficult this is to bridge with the providers. We haven't had in-depth discussions. I don't know if they have any particular thoughts on that or not. So it's not quite clear to me exactly how much work this is.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I wanted to insert on 1.4 after the first A, one page, a one page form.
And Madam Chair, if I could just respond also to
that would be incorporated, Senator Higgins. Senator Olson.
I know that the working group that studied this issue has done a lot of things to try to make make the job easier for the medical profession, and patients will certainly benefit from that, so I'm certainly not criticizing that effort. But their task was not directed toward making it easier for the patient or the consumer. And this is at least one thing that we could add to the piece of legislation that would make the process much less onerous and confusing and potentially expensive for the patient in terms of their access to records. And so I really think that there's language, Senator Betzold, that says a form developed by the commissioner must be accepted by a provider as a legally enforceable request under this section. So in other words, we're not telling them this is optional. We're saying they have to honor the form if this form is used.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest, Senator Olson, that you delete on line 1.4 and make available to the public. That way you'd reduce all of the cost and shift it over to the user.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess if there's a different language, we could say, when I say make available to the public, I just mean that somehow, not that they have to distribute it to the public, but that somehow the public has to know there is a form available, and how we can do that without, we can say must create, must implement. Certainly, I guess, if this form has been created.
I think Senator Foley's suggestion does make sense.
Okay.
You just want the department to develop the form and have that be used. So I think that makes sense. That suggestion, deleting on line 1.4A, make available to the public, just delete that. Anybody from the providers who strenuously object to this? All right. Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Wimmer.
I might suggest a verbal amendment on page 1, line 21. There was a brief comment about other non-clinical data that might be used to identify a patient. We don't know. We haven't gotten any reaction of what that was. I would like to move to strike on page 1, line 21, and other non-clinical data.
About comma and other non-clinical data.
And then insert the word and before the word parents on line 20. I just believe that other non-clinical data is too broad.
Senator Higgins.
That non-clinical data may mean it's your health plan number. It may mean a whole lot of other things that are non-clinical, as in not part of your physical, stuff. But it is data that uniquely identifies you in your clinic or in your health plan. So I think that I would encourage us not to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, we could put in under health record or under identification information, you could insert in addition to this a health care number if available. But keeping the words and other non-clinical data, that's rather broad. It could be anything. And I just would like to keep it limited to the purposes of this Records Act.
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, I don't... A, B, C. Yeah.
I disagree with Senator Limbers that it could be anything, because it's got to be data that can be used to uniquely identify the patient. So if it can't uniquely identify the patient, I don't think it belongs as identifying information. So I think it's fairly narrow as I read this.
Madam Chair, we're identifying the identifying information in line 19. Patient's name, address, date of birth, gender, parent or guardian's names. I don't know how much more information we need to identify someone. Scars, tattoos, or fingerprints, I suppose, but I don't think we need to go that far.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I have a constituent who has twin daughters. They are named Maria and Mariah. Their names are spelled the same. I have no idea why. But they were born the same day. They have the same parents. They have the same address. They have the same gender. And, I don't know what you use to identify the two of them, but Maria and Mariah would have to have some non-clinical data that would make them.
Senator Limmer has made his case. Let's take a vote on it, unless you would like to withdraw your motion, Senator Limmer. You want to vote on it?
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor of Senator Limmer's amendment to line 1.21, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Sorry. The motion does not prevail. Senator Higgins votes no. Senator Neville. It's okay, Senator Higgins. It's better than me voting for my bill that's in another committee that I'm not a member of.
That was 1-1. I saw that.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest an oral amendment, too. We deleted some language on line 10.7 through 10.23.
This is so
bad. I do think that was appropriate to delete that from this allocation of liability section. But what that language does, subparagraphs A through C, is it creates warranties as to the authenticities of consents. In three cases, the person warrants that the consent doesn't have information known to be false, etc. That the person who's disclosing doesn't have any information that he knows is false. And I think it would be appropriate to keep that language and to reinsert it in the consent section. We've created a liability section that says any violation of this provision creates civil liability. If we just move that language, lines 10.7 through 10.23, over to insert that after line 4.29, I think it would fit well and would create the duties that we want, that we expect of people who are proffering consents.
Senator Higgins?
I think I agree. I do note that in 10.11, you all took the representation out, so we need to take the representation out there.
Okay.
But I think that makes sense to me.
Senator Betzel?
It seems to make sense as I'm reading and trying to cut and paste in my mind.
Right.
Okay. All right. Ms. Pontius, do you know what Senator Neville was intending?
Yes.
Yeah.
That language over. Right. Deleting the representation language.
All right. Ms. Pontius, being a wonderful scribe that she is, will make the Senator Neville amendment come alive in the bill. All those in favor of the Neville Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1701, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor.
Rules Committee.
Well, the Rules Committee can capture it.
Yeah, they're going to capture it.
That's the appropriate. Any further discussions? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, thank you so much for your time, Senator Betzel. We apologize for the time it took.
No, thank you for the accommodation, Madam Chair.
I know the health department would like to see this moving. And Senator Olson, you may want to just take your other amendments and have that put into a bill form and introduce before May 21st, so people can start looking at it between now and next year. And that's our first bill for next year, I would hope.
You know what? I'm gonna do that because that'll give people the chance to take a look at it over the interim. Thanks for that suggestion, since it's already put together anyway.
Yeah.
We are in agreement.